You're listening to Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm in conversation with other people about their practice and approach to life. Today's episode is with Nicole Byers, a longtime friend and kindred spirit. In this conversation, she shares how a challenging home life while growing up helped her to develop an appreciation for self-reflection, as well as strong, supportive friendships. Our fur babies also chime in on occasion. Content notification, there's some punny swearing. If you enjoy this episode, please share it and visit CaitlinSCHatch.com to leave a tip to help fund the production of the show. And now, on to my conversation with Nick. Do you know how long we've known each other? I was trying to think in preparation.
You know what? It was funny because I was talking to someone about this yesterday and I realized that we've known each other for 17 years.
Wow. See, that's a long time.
That is actually a very long time.
It is a very long time. And I've got some other friendships where I've got that longevity. But what I find very interesting in preparing for interviewing you for the show is that I was thinking about, we have known each other for ages. And then I realized something, because as I've been doing this season, and I've started to get a formula for each episode and the questions that I ask, and then like taking a page from Krista Tippett from On Being, where she always starts off with a really good opening question, where she asks people what, if any, spiritual influence they had in their childhood. So like, I've created my question of saying, can you tell me a bit about your practice and approach to life? And it occurred to me that despite being friends with you for 17 years, I don't actually know how you describe your practice or spirituality or whatever.
Which is actually quite funny because that is pretty much how I feel. I don't really have a definition.
Oh,
I don't really follow one thing or another. But I do have things that I do in order to maintain, I guess, my mental health, so to speak. So I kind of approach it, like, I've always been very interested in, like, energy type stuff. So, you know, for example, I've read The Wheels of Life by Anna Day Judith. Okay. And really enjoyed that, but don't use that as a daily thing in my life. I do meditate on a regular basis, I would say probably, you know, once a day at least,
mm-hmm.
which is just something that I've learned to do to keep my sanity and keep me thinking about the present, because I do quite often worry myself into the future.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I was younger, we didn't really have any structured religion or anything. My dad would sometimes pull out one and only Bible we had in the house and would pick one of the scariest possible stories on whatever holiday it happened to be, whether it be Christmas, Easter, and would tell us his scary interpretation.
Really?
Very, very true. Very true.
That's so weird. I had no idea. It's interesting because I realized that actually I don't really know about sort of the spiritual background or approach for most of my friends.
It's true because people don't really talk about it, right? And for me, it was, well, I always attributed that specific type of God to my father exaggerating and lying and telling big tall tales and things like that. So I always thought of it as more of a story.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got older, I started to realize after just kind of, you know, talking to people of different religions, because I was always friends with people who spanned, you know, every type of religion I could think of.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really knew any of them very well. But at the same time, I knew bits and pieces, and really the core of everything was just kindness and love and kind of that basic, you know, treat your human fellow beings like human beings.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way I like to live my life, is just to treat others with kindness and to realize that no one's doing anything because they want to hurt someone else.
So that's sort of the thing about us as friends. Because I think of, you know, how you've got circles of friends that sort of expand out, and you have like the closer ones, and then you have ones who are kind of like hangout friends maybe, and then you've got your acquaintances and so on. But I think of within my close, intimate circle of friends, even within there, I've got friends who are, I count as sort of a spiritual council. if you will.
Yes. It doesn't matter their background. There's just almost like a wiseness amongst certain friends.
Yeah, and so you're one of those friends, right? I think, honestly, there's basically two of you.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored.
But I think it's interesting because, like, what it means is, like, you're this person that I really turn to because despite the fact that, you know, I identify as Buddhist and you don't really have, like, a structured religion that you follow or any kind of specific spirituality that you follow, we basically have the same approach, like you just said, right? Like kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what works really well. I mean, we've done lots of work together on personal things, not necessarily in relationship to each other, just but like, I've brought you some of my deepest, darkest bits, and you've brought me some of your deepest, darkest bits. So what is it about that kind of, like, this sort of relationship, this sort of friendship that is valuable for you?
Oh, that's such a good point, because we really have, you know, no matter the distance, and I do think about that quite often, we've always maintained this real closeness and realness, and almost a rawness, right? And I think the value in that is that you know there's always someone who's going to give you an opinion that doesn't tell you what you should do. It doesn't tell you what they would do to solve it. They're going to be there and support you and maybe even just give you a little insight that maybe you didn't think about before. But just knowing that you can open up and be that vulnerable to someone is very difficult for me. You know, I don't talk to a lot of people about those really private things. So it's even the source of stress relief.
I guess it's that being able to, it's something that I've kind of touched on in the show before and have been talking to a lot of people about recently, that there's a difference between being safe and being comfortable. And you can find people that you're really safe with to have uncomfortable conversations with. So you can have an uncomfortable conversation about something that is either like just generally uncomfortable for you and something that's going on with your life, or actually could be something that is uncomfortable in the aspect of how you relate with that person, but because you're safe with them. So there's this sense of being able to trust that I can bring you something and you're not going to be judgmental of it. And any feedback that you give, I trust that you're giving because you care about me.
And that is exactly it, is finding someone who's not going to judge you, whether you know you've made a bad decision or not.
Mm.
Or if it's just a general situation that maybe they wouldn't see themselves in, but because they love you and they see that you're in that situation, they can at least have an objective insight to what you're going through.
Mm-hmm. What I value about these kinds of friendships is that it, for me, is really teaching me what it is that I'm doing when I meditate in making friends with myself. If that's what I value in how someone else treats me, then I should really be treating myself that way.
How true, right? We often don't give ourselves credit for the things that we admire in others that we actually do possess.
Yeah. Or the things that we will do for others in a friendship, we don't necessarily always pass on to ourselves. And I think that what you're saying about distance, so like we've maintained a friendship. Like I was living in the UK for 6 years while you were still in Canada. And then when we were younger, when we first met, like you left Calgary and we didn't talk to each other for years. But whenever we've reconnected, it's always just been like we picked up right where we left off, just jumped in. No sense of kind of animosity or like, well, I don't know what's going on in your life or whatever it is. It's just sort of like, yeah, well, let's find out, you know, and be open and curious.
None of this, where have you been or why didn't you call? Because, it, you know, it does take two people, right?
Yeah.
And life happens. Just because life happens, it doesn't mean that someone isn't a wonderful person that I want in my life.
That's a really good point, actually, because I think that friendships can evolve in many different ways over time. And I think it's interesting, having known you since we were both teenagers in particular, because you change a lot when you're a teenager.
Oh, so much.
and then into being an adult. And what I remember was that whenever we would hang out at punk shows, to give people context, I think between the two of us, we probably annoyed our friends because we were sort of like, we mothered them.
Oh, yes, very much. You and I were both, despite outward appearances, you know, we're both very motherly and very caring and actually very bubbly.
Yeah.
And smiley, which was not the usual amongst our friends.
Yeah, we're all very angsty and depressed. Not that we weren't angsty and depressed, but...
Oh. We were. But we were the ones that didn't show it as much because we were taking care of the rest of our angsty and depressed friends.
And it was, I mean, we weren't always good at it. I know that, like, for me, it was more making sure things like, did you guys eat? And then I'd be resentful because I was like, well, you ate, but you ate my food. So funny. So we had this gap when your family moved away from Calgary. And I mean, this was all before the internet really was what the internet is now. So staying in touch wasn't very so much. Easy. And I remember when we reconnected, and that was what I was... I think in my early 20s then.
Absolutely. It was quite a few years later, I think. Probably would have been maybe 2005.
Yeah. When did you move away?
I moved away in the summer of 2001.
Okay.
And we did move back in, it would have been November of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But when I moved back, I lived in a different neighborhood, and I kind of spent a lot of time isolating myself because I had such a hard time with the move and kind of losing all the friend base I had built.
Yeah. Then when we reconnected, what I remember so much about that was that it was like, it wasn't that you weren't different. It was like you were more of yourself.
Yes. And for both of us, I think so. And I think that we were both kind of in a tough point in our lives, and we felt like we were kind of starting to become who we were. And at that point, it is an easy point in life to reconnect.
Why do you think that is? When there's like a major transition that you might reconnect with people that you knew from before?
I think sometimes because they've gone through a transition as well. And so it's kind of exciting to see, you know, what direction did everyone go in and, you know, how is everyone starting to form their adult lives? Because you always think of it one way before you really feel like an adult. And then, you know, you get into your 20s and it's a very in-between time as much as we don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, was doing the adult thing, but I sure didn't feel like an adult.
I know. I think, I guess that's it, right? It's because when you're in your early 20s, you're like, well, now I'm an adult, but you're not really. Like, I think back to being in before 25, basically between 19 and 25.
Definitely.
Like, I was such a baby.
Oh, totally. I look at some of the decisions I made or some of the reactions I had to other people in my life at the time, and I realized that a lot of my reactions were still very juvenile, where, you know, I'm still living in my own place and paying my way and working a job, but at the same time, my attitudes hadn't changed a whole lot. So it was very interesting because you're kind of on the verge of letting go of those attitudes.
What kind of attitudes?
Almost like a separation between myself and adults still, right. You know, like I'm still a rebel and, you know, I'm becoming who I am, but I still have this rebel side, which I've definitely let go of a lot more as an actual adult.
Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with rebellion, but I think I remember like my experiences thinking that I was really special in my rebellion and very unique.
Yes.
Like, oh my God, adults are so clueless. They have no idea.
Yes, exactly. Whereas when you actually feel like an adult, you realize that everyone's had a form of rebellion.
So it's interesting because I think like our friendship really cemented in that time because our friendship before when we were teenagers was more circumstantial based on the fact that we hung out at the same shows.
Yeah. Like, for the most part, we were always at the shows together, you know? There'd be the odd time where we'd plan something else, like a drinking binge, or everyone's going to meet and go to the zoo or whatever. Like, there were little things like that that people would do that would kind of get people together, but for the most part, it was the music.
Yeah. And I think it's also just like when you're a teenager, what you want to do and how you connect with people can be very superficial, even if you don't think it is because you think you're such a rebel.
Oh, so much. I do believe the first time I spoke to you because you had blue hair.
Yeah. Well, that was basically how I made friends as a teenager. We're having blue hair. Yeah, and it, I remember you had ears in your hoodie.
Whatever the conversation starter was, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, well, you have a cool hoodie with little cat ears on it, and that's awesome. And I have blue hair, and that's awesome, so we can be awesome together. So it's cool because our friendship then actually really cemented at the time when we were figuring out a lot more about who we are as people. And what it means to human, I think, for me, definitely. I don't know about for you, but I was definitely learning what it meant to human at that point, which was, like, basically learning that it was okay that I felt shitty sometimes.
Totally. 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 Yeah, when I was a teenager, it was very upsetting to have a bad day or very upsetting to, you know, think about my home life situation. And so for me, as I got older, it was the main goal at first was to do something else, you know, not be stuck and attached to my family because of the circumstances that we were in. And so that was the main goal. But then once I did that, it was trying to figure out what I wanted to do beyond that.
So how did you get to that point? Like, what was it that sort of shifted? Because, and I don't know how much you want to talk about your upbringing and your family and stuff, but I know this is something that you and I have talked about personally, where you have such a self-reflective approach. There's sort of this sense that people need to learn that somehow and have it modeled. And it wasn't necessarily modeled to you and your family, but you clearly have figured out how to self-reflect and kind of take personal responsibility. And you've cultivated this approach to life that, as far as I'm concerned, is like incredibly sane and wise and mature, but you didn't necessarily have it modeled from your family. So where did you find it? Where did you connect with it?
Well, first of all, thank you. I like to think that I've done well despite my circumstances. And it's quite funny as an adult now that I don't think of them to be as serious as they were, but really every step of the way, it felt very serious. Mm. So I'm usually pretty open with how I grew up. So my dad has paranoid schizophrenia. And so he was a very scary person to grow up with. Very controlling, very paranoid, of course, and just a very rigid idea of how everyone around him should live their life.
And I think, well, good to note, like, untreated paranoid schizophrenia.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a key point, is that he was untreated, you know? He did not want to take medication. He didn't want the stigma attached to it to affect his ability to be employed. And for many, many, many years, he stayed employed. I remember he worked for one company for about 13 years. So, you know, he was able to maintain a career for a very long time until I was in my 12th grade. And that was when he kind of started to go downhill. So for me, I really do think the amount of time that I spent on my own as a preteen and teenager really had a lot to do with me being so self-reflective. Right. I was also very much bullied in school all through elementary and junior high. And then in high school, as my look became more dark and I became more of that angsty goth child, I definitely wasn't bullied as much. So it was more about my home situation as I got older. Mm-hmm. So I started off kind of spending a lot of time in my room, being very self-reflective, you know, being very present because I didn't have anything else to do. And as I got older, it was a lot easier to get to know people and expose myself to them. And so I had quite a few people that I was quite close with. And you probably remember Lisa as being one of those people. Mm-hmm. I give her a ton of credit because she and I pretty much got each other through the beginning of high school.
Right.
And so after that, it was just the time I spent alone, I guess. I always spent a lot of time alone. I always journaled a lot. If I didn't know how to deal with a situation, I'd just start writing.
Do you think as well, part of like watching a mental illness go untreated was part of the motivator for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because seeing someone almost have an answer in front of them or what could have been a solution, to see them refuse, that was very difficult for me. And to see the fear my dad had of the stigma attached to being labeled with a mental illness and being put on medication. And he was a truck driver, so that wasn't, you know, men were tough. They're expected to be tough, and they're not expected to have flaws, and, you know, they can't be vulnerable. So it was very, very hard for him, and he did not want to admit that a big, tough, strong, hardworking man could not be okay or need some support.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you experiencing the knock-on effect of how that affected your mom and your siblings and yourself.
Absolutely. Our entire family. Yeah. Our entire.
So journaling. A few of my guests have talked about journaling and the different ways they use it. And for me, it's something like, it's very funny whenever I've been to see therapists and I talk to them about journaling and how great it is for me. And then they would give me the really sound advice to journal. I'm like, yeah, I already told you it was great. I have figured that one out. But I think the question that never gets asked or talked about as much is why journaling works. And I think also that there's some perceptions, misconceptions around how journaling should be done. I've talked to a lot of people who are like, oh, I can't journal because my handwriting is terrible. I'm like, oh, you should see my handwriting. It's atrocious. So how would you describe, like, first of all, your style of journaling, and then also how it works for you? Like, what is it about journaling that you find so beneficial?
So for me, one of the big things is I am one of those people that you're talking about that's like, oh, my handwriting is too terrible, and I am very self-critical. Chris will vouch for me that I just spent half an hour writing a nice, neat little meal plan on 7 different pieces of paper. So I definitely am very self-critical of the writing, but when I'm journaling, I have to keep in mind that I'm probably never going to go back and read it. And if I do, I'm not going to care about what the writing looks like. Mm-hmm. No one else is going to see it. It's not for someone else's eyes. It's for me. And I look at journaling very much as, for me, it has to flow. I can't, you know, say I'm going to sit down at 6 p.m. every day and put a journal entry in. It totally has to flow. I have to be like, you know what? I'm going to write this down because I'm excited about it, or I'm upset about it, or I need to get it out on paper so I can look at it clearly. So I very much use it as a tool for really clearing my head.
Sort of like processing something or getting stuff out. I think of it as like a thought dump sometimes.
Totally. Totally. That is such a great term for a thought dump, because really that's always for me what it's been, you know, having been through with things with my dad. I didn't have anyone to talk to about it. It wasn't like my friends were in the same situation, and it wasn't like my brother and sister. My brother and sister are both younger than me, so they didn't process it the same way as I did, because when they were younger, there was no talk of mental illness. We just thought my dad was a crazy angry man. And so for me, always being interested in knowing where things like that came from, I've always been interested in psychology and things like that. So right off the bat in junior high, when they offered courses like that, I took them. I always felt like I had a little bit more understanding of what he was like and what he might have been going through.
So that's interesting. I mean, there's a level of empathy going on there, which I think when you're a teenager as well can be very difficult, especially for our parents.
I think one of the number one reasons that I refused to really latch on to any religion was because, in my opinion, as a child, how could someone so all powerful let a scary man like my dad keep on living while these, you know, wonderful people are dying every day?
Right.
And so that was, as a kid, a very motivating factor for me to be like, no, I'm not a believer in God. As I got older, I realized, you know, anything like that is never just the good, right? It's the balance of life.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess when you're a teenager, like having a conversation like that with other teenagers, I know that we like to fool ourselves into thinking we can have those deep conversations, but
really,
we didn't. I mean, when I think about it, honestly, at the time that I knew you as a teenager, I had no idea what your life was like. I didn't know what any of my friends' home life was like, really.
Sometimes maybe the extent of it was, you know, you knew certain friends had a harder home life. you know, never had sleepovers at that friend's house.
Exactly.
Or there were times that they would get grounded or things like that, you know. There are little indications that as a teenager, you're like, oh, their parents are just strict.
And I think also there's almost a selfishness in that teenagers just don't acknowledge. Like, I would definitely say that my problems felt much more important than anyone else's problems.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. Like, and even in the journaling, right? Like, mm-hmm. a lot of my journaling in my teenage years was very dark and angry, and no one understands, and no one's like me, and I am alone, and no one's ever going to understand what I've been through.
Mm-hmm.
Where now, as an adult, I consistently meet people who have struggled just as much, if not more,
mm-hmm.
some of them less, but everyone really, that cliche that everyone has a story is so very true.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing about cliches. They're often very true. That's why they become cliches.
so true.
That then brings me to the situation, which really I just want to talk about, because I think it's a good example then of when you're an adult. And we have this thing where, and it's something that people talk about, where people say when someone asks how you are, they don't really mean it. They don't really want to know, or it's hard for us to talk about something that's going on in our lives that's really difficult because we don't want to burden people or whatever it is. But the approach to something really crappy happening and all the different ways that you can literally crappy happening, and, the listeners will understand in a moment. But I guess just like parsing out a little bit about all the different ways that you can approach a situation and all the different ways you can talk about it and get support around it, understanding that support doesn't mean you're asking people to fix something, which I think as teenagers, we think that that's what it's about. Like, we want you to fix it. But as an adult, we might be like, I just want you to listen. That kind of thing. So let's just set the scene of the situation. You've already mentioned Chris, your husband. So he was away.
Yes. So this would have been almost about 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
in April of 2015. And my husband was on a road trip with his brother and his brother's fiance, and they were moving to Thunder Bay. So he took the long trip from Calgary to Thunder Bay with them in the U-Haul.
So he was far, far away.
far, far away from the situation. So my sister and I had gotten tickets to a burlesque show for the first Sunday that he was gone. The first Saturday that he was gone. And so she stayed the night. And normally I sleep on the side of the bed closer to the door because Chris is more comfortable on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But because my sister had stayed the night, I let her stay on that side because it's closer to the washroom, easier to find your way around.
Yeah.
We both slept in. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and got up, kind of walked around the bed. At the time, we were in an apartment with carpet,
uh-huh.
and I walked around the side of the bed, and all of a sudden, I just squished my toes into the most soppy, wet carpet, and at first, I had no clue what was going on. And I literally had curses flying out of my mouth and woke my sister up with them. And she jets up and sits up. What's going on? What's going on? At the time, I wasn't sure.
Right.
So the bathroom is right next to the bedroom. So I open up the door to realize that there is sewage floating in my tub, in the toilet, overflowing onto the floor.
Yeah. So for listeners, this is why we said situation and not situation.
Literally, situation. Other people's feces floating in the water in my home. So this had actually been going on long enough that it had flooded into the hallway and into the bedroom closet, which is why I had stepped into this water when I came around the side of the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was my sister and I called my mom, and my mom lives about 10, 15 minute drive away. And we gathered up my two cats and she picked us up and we went to their place.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were waiting for her, I packed a little bit of a bag while I had myself on the phone with our maintenance for the building. And they had told us that it was, in fact, a sewage flood, and it was actually happening on the entire first floor of the apartment building, which was terrible in itself, although I was the only person that was gathering up my stuff and leaving.
Weird.
Apparently, the rest of the apartments had only had their washrooms flooded.
Wow.
Where by the time they had come in and finally shut off the water, 3/4 of our apartment had flooded with sewage. Wow. So it was through the hallway, through the closets, through the storage, through the first bedroom and part of the second bedroom, and just barely hitting the living room area and yes. dining area. Wow. So it was pretty bad. When we came back after they had turned on the water, it was ankle deep.
Wow.
In most parts. It was pretty disgusting. The bottoms of the walls were just soaked through. It was pretty disgusting. The smell in there is unlike anything I've ever smelled before. And this includes the neighbor down the hall that passed away and wasn't noticed for 2 weeks.
Wow.
The smell was worse. Thank God it was warm enough that we had all the windows open.
But also warm enough to help that smell along, I'm sure.
Yes, definitely, definitely. So because of the situation, or situation, they had come in and basically sucked out all the water. But because the other apartments didn't have such a bad issue, they didn't check all the apartments. So they didn't realize that ours was terrible, and they told us that we could move back in. So when I came back, the water had been sucked out of the carpet, but the feces had been ground into the carpet.
Nice.
And the walls were still soaked through. So Alberta Health Services did assist me in coming and testing everything and deeming the apartment uninhabitable. And so the building management moved us into another apartment, which we're still in now.
Right. So, okay, so to backpedal a little bit, when this first happened, you had your sister there, and you had your mom to do that kind of, like, instant support, trying to figure things out, get you out and into a safe space. Now, I remember seeing you post something on Facebook about it. Can you talk a bit about sort of the... Because I think that one of the things, Facebook sort of gets vilified as this place where people go and post things because they're looking for sympathy, and it's like gets all your vague booking or whatever. But like, I remember you posted to Facebook, and what was great, and I do see this with other people and other things, they go, terrible thing happening right now, posting to Facebook, and they get flooded with messages of people who are just like, oh my God, that's so crappy. Literally. And it was somebody on Facebook who called it this situation, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know what it was? Is a friend of mine, Maggie, had texted me not long after, and she basically texted that, hey, I heard about the situation, and then in brackets, ha ha ha, you know, how is everything going? But, which was actually really lovely, of course, because it shows that people do care and they see things like that and they want to check in and make sure you're okay. But the funniest part of that all was that my phone still to this day,
Duff is so happy.
My phone still to this day autocorrects situation to situation. So I definitely give credit to Maggie for coining that term, because we have lovingly called it so ever since.
Yeah, and I guess like what I like about that is you're telling this story and we're laughing, but it wasn't funny. And for anyone who's actually been through something like that, that's not funny when you wake up to that. It's not funny definitely. While it's happening. But it's so nice not to funny. have a friend who can just be like, I realize your thing sucks really badly, but also I'm still going to make a joke. And not to belittle the experience, but just to kind of like, I guess it gives perspective, right? You're like, oh, well, this thing's happening, but you know, it's not the end of the world and we can make a pun.
Yes, yes. And she totally understood what I was going through too, because 2 years earlier, the apartment building she was living in was affected when the floods came through Calgary.
Right,
so
there you go.
She definitely understood what I was going through.
Yeah, well, and a lot of people would have, like...
Yes. I mean, it may have not been entirely sewage that came through their homes, but it's enough, and, you know, the dirt and everything, the debris that comes through, it's just as bad.
Exactly. So it's nice because there's that sort of camaraderie where it's like, even though somebody's not necessarily directly there to help in the way that your mom and your sister were, there's still that help because there's that rallying around through shared experience, and people are like,
Yes.
oh, I know what that's like, and it's awful, and I'm really sorry you have to go through that.
Definitely. And I was very lucky to have my mom because with Chris being away, someone had to deal with the contents of the apartment.
Yeah.
So my lovely, lovely, lovely mom, I cannot thank her enough. She and I dug through every feces-covered item in the home, saved what we could that hadn't been touched by any of the flooding, and we actually spent 3 days in the home because we couldn't spend too much time at a time.
No.
So we'd do about 4 hours a day and come and just clear out whatever we could. And thank God she helped me. And then her and actually a mutual friend that was a roommate of both of ours, Allie, she actually came through at the end as well. And they all helped us move all the remaining belongings into the new apartment.
That was really nice. It's nice because it's sort of like all the different ways that you can show up for a person and help them,
Definitely.
and then also appreciating in those experiences those kinds of friends, right? Like the various ways that your
Yeah.
friends show up for you.
Well, it's true, right? No one enjoys moving. No one wants to help their friends move.
Not really, no.
They do it because they're loving and they care and they happen to be available. And sometimes that's the most amazing way that someone can show up for you as a friend.
So then the other aspect of this situation is that you go through and you're cleaning your stuff up, and you had a lot of stuff, and this for me,
Oh.
like as a Buddhist, talking about attachment and non-attachment, what that looks like. You had a lot of stuff that was ruined.
Definitely. I mean, in some aspects, it was all well. Like, for example, we had a large pile of stuff that we had intended to donate. So, no loss to us, but it was a shame that we weren't able to. Like, I had a ton of stuff that we were going to take to the women's walk-in closet and things like that. So, in a way, it was a shame, but for us, of course, no loss. But there were things that meant a lot more in terms of function. We lost some furniture. We lost our king size bed that we had to buy when we moved into that place. So we'd only had it about 3 years. We lost, of course, our bedside tables, anything that was sitting in the closets. Chris had a very nice and expensive Santa suit we lost. One of the most devastating seeming things to have lost was I had kind of like a long oblong box that contained all of my saved artwork from the time that I was about 11 years old, all the way through till probably about 21. And so this was things I had done in school, experiments, really accomplished things, and all of these were just absolutely destroyed.
Right. So obviously all the like the furniture stuff to a certain extent, you've got your insurance that'll cover and replace that. But something like that, you're talking about something that's just pure sentimental value. You can't replace it.
Yes, and actually, in our case, we had very minimal insurance. It was basically tenant insurance was required, so we got the bare minimum. It actually didn't cover flooding.
Oh
And so they had considered it water damage, and so we were not actually covered for anything.
Oh, that's rough.
Which was rough, but you know what? Another case of friends coming through. We had friend who had a spare bed that had been sitting in her garage,
That's
and
lovely.
before that it had been sitting in someone else's spare room, and so she told us we could have the bed if we came and picked it up.
That's awesome.
So we were very lucky in that case that the things that were really necessary, like having a bed to sleep on, were taken care of by friends with just a quick ask on Facebook.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then what do you do about the stuff that can't be replaced that is sentimental, like that art?
So the funny thing is, I expected myself to be just broken over it. I thought I would be devastated. There was so much in there that I was very proud of, and there were quite a few items that I really attached to who I was in high school. Things that were, got done when I was going through hard times in high school.
Right.
And I never thought I was going to get over it. But even from the very beginning, I didn't care.
Really?
I mean, one of my first thoughts was, I'm sorry, this is literally someone else's crap. I'm not touching it. To be honest, it was literally like that outweighed the sentimental value is the fact that this is literally someone else's crap on my stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You spoke about the flooding that happened in Calgary. Was that 2013, I think?
It was, yeah.
And I know that that was a big part of it for so many people, and I would see footage regularly of people saying, you know, we can replace these things, we can rebuild the basement, we can do that, but, like, I can't get back these family photographs, I can't get back my kids' artwork, I can't get back these things, and that devastation. And I think that we always expect, like, of course, right, sentimental value to things, but there is something about sort of the perspective that you gained.
It honestly didn't change how I felt about those moments in my life that those things were attached to. Mm-hmm. And it didn't mean that I forgot any of those things. You know, I still miss going through them once in a while, but it was more for the memories, and I still have those.
Mm-hmm. And like, what is it about the quality of the memory? Like, do you think, because I think sometimes we attach like the stuff to the trigger of the memory, but I've started to realize that that's not always the case.
You know what? I definitely felt that way, that that was what triggered the memory. But now the thought of having had the thing that I've lost still triggers the memory.
Which, of course, you wouldn't know that until you had to experience it, right?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I definitely used to hold a lot of sentimental value on things. Things I thought that if I ever lost them, I would be really upset. And now I realize it doesn't really change the course of my life to lose those things.
Mm-hmm. And then within that sort of situation, there's the stuff that you lose, but then there's the things that you see that you have that are really valuable, like those friendships and those connections. Yes.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, in life, those connections are way more important to me than having that piece of artwork.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So what are some supports or guidance or resources or something that you'd like to offer to listeners? Because you are one of the people I've interviewed where you don't have like a specific spiritual background, but I know that you... We've talked about some stuff that we listen to, like you've recommended certain podcasts and stuff. So what are supports and guidance that you would like to offer to listeners?
So myself, I definitely rely on my friends a lot for a lot of those resources, yourself included.
Yeah.
Anyone, big or small, I recommend your first published book, The Wise at Any Age.
Aww.
That is definitely great for anyone who's at the beginning of a journey, right?
That's so sweet, because I never plug
that. And I know, I know I'm not required, but really, truly, I think that is a really great place for anyone to start that maybe is like me and doesn't have a basis for what they believe in. I also credit my friends for introducing me to some really good sources of just a general different look at the world. So recommended to me many, many years ago, I guess it probably was 2011, is it's a website called Mark and Angel Hack Life, Practical Tips for Productive Living. And I ran into this site because a friend recommended a single post.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up spending hours reading all these different lists and posts. And I really admire the outlook they have on life, and that we really are responsible for how we feel and what we do. So if anyone wants to check that out, it's at www.markandangel.com, and that's MarkandAngel. And then I definitely want to recommend an app that I personally use just to kind of guide me with daily meditations. You know, picking the right meditation for the right time, just kind of learning to sit with the meditation. So I've been using the Stop, Breathe, and Think app.
Okay.
And people can find that and any information about it at www.stopbreathethink.org.
Cool.
And those are my main two daily things. I mean, even some people may have seen my Instagram post with my sister's birthday present where I did a whole bunch of kind of letters that say read when, for example, you need confidence or motivation, or read when you have a bad day. So I made her up a whole bunch of those, and quite a few of them I actually ended up including lists from Mark and Angel Hack Life. So I definitely use those for myself and for others in daily life.
I like that. That seems like a really good idea, writing letters of like recommendations.
Because I felt I was pinched for time when I did it, so I felt like it was too much of an undertaking to write the letters myself and to really have them be meaningful in such a short span of time.
Yeah.
And so I looked for things that were meaningful to me in those situations, and a lot of those happened to be sourced from that website. So
that's cool.
Yeah, I definitely, the recommendation came to me when I was at a really tough point where I was kind of figuring out my adult life. I was 27. So just beyond that 25 point where you really start to feel like an adult and want to get your direction and start digging your feet in with what you're doing with life. So it came at a good point in time.
That's cool. And it's still a useful resource. That's nice to hear. Like that it
many years later. Yeah.
Yeah. It's always cool when you find stuff like that. And apps are great because if you've got an app on your phone for something as well, that's like, I've got few little resource apps that are like, well, the one that you recommended actually, Transform Your Life app.
Ah, yes, that one's a good one because it has a daily message and kind of gives you a small challenge every day and a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, I still have that on my phone. It's been on my phone for like 3 years and it's the same stuff every year, but for me, I like that checking in regularly.
Yes. Yes, just because you've seen it once doesn't mean you always think of it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that app came to me in a very, very difficult time, and I was just literally searching for apps that would help with anxiety.
Right.
And I found that one a huge, huge, huge help. It got me through a really, really tough time along with some other tools.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about what I do, visit caitlinschatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, read my blog, check out my artwork, and leave a tip to help support my work in the world. You can also make suggestions for guests for the show, be it a spiritual teacher you admire and study under, or if you yourself have a practice that supports you. You can fill in the guest suggestion form on my site under the podcast link. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.